Rwandans are marking the 25th 5 years since the beginning of a meticulously organised campaign of genocide described by the UN as one of the darkest chapters in recent human history. 100 days of mourning has been declared, marking the time in 1994 in which Hutu extremists slaughtered at least 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus. Speaking at a memorial service in the capital Kigali, Rwanda's president, Paul Kagame, who led the rebel force to end the slaughter, says the country has become a family once again. But for many survivors, of course, this trauma will never leave them. Justice Ian Morley QC is a former prosecutor at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. He's now a High Court judge in Antigua and Montserrat. Ian Morley, welcome to RN Breakfast.
Hello, good morning, Fran, and good morning to Australia.
During its operation, the tribunal, the UN tribunal for Rwanda, where you worked as a prosecutor for those 4 years, imposed, I think it was over 60 sentences and dozens of convictions for genocide. In your view, have the key perpetrators been brought to justice? Have enough people been brought to justice?
Right, well, two questions there. I think the key folks have been brought to justice. I think there's one fugitive which we haven't been able to track down. He may be lurking somewhere in Kenya. In terms of have enough people been brought to justice, there's been a twin approach. The UN dealt with the most senior figures within the Rwanda genocide, and the Rwandans themselves dealt with very large numbers of on-the-ground perpetrators. There were tens of thousands convicted over in Rwanda. I think there were about 60 senior figures who were convicted by the UN Rwanda Tribunal, which sat in Arusha, Tanzania. So the short answer is, yes, a lot of people have gone through the justice process, but the UN dealt with the top people.
And the tribunal, this UN tribunal, was the first international court to pass judgment on genocide. How difficult was that to get these prosecutions of such a grave crime without legal precedent?
Well, there was a lot of work done to set the ground rules. There was a lot of work done to establish the jurisdiction of the court in the early days, between about 1998 and 2002. And once the legal framework was set in place, then all the trials started moving through the system, some slower than others. In terms of securing convictions for genocide, it is a sad fact that what happened in Rwanda was undeniably a genocide within the definition by the UN. Once the evidence was laid before the court, genocide was going to be the inevitable conviction if a person was said to be involved in it or organising it.
Okay.
So it wasn't very complicated legally to secure the convictions.
I want to come to the organised element of it in a moment, but supporters of the tribunal for Rwanda argue that its judgments serve as a powerful deterrent to others contemplating similar crimes or organising similar genocides in the future, that they send a message to those who commit genocide or other atrocities that, regardless of your position, you'll go on unpunished. Do you think that's true? Because it seems to me there's a lot of terrible things occurring, conflicts and populations being, targeted and attacked at the moment, and the world does not seem to have much capacity or power to deal with it.
Well, I think that deterrence is an element of all of it. How successful it is in due course, only history as it proceeds will tell. But the other part to the tribunal's work has been to give a voice to the many thousands of people who were affected by the Rwanda genocide, who otherwise would have been voiceless, also to create a record of what it is that happened there in Rwanda during those terrible 100 days between the 6th of April and, I think, the 15th of July of 1994. So The tribunal hasn't been simply about deterrence. It has been about accountability and creating an opportunity for people to have their day in court and to be able to remember what happened then.
Let's remember now what happened to them. This genocide is said to be sparked by the shooting down of the plane carrying Rwanda's then president and his Burundian counterpart. How did that incident set off a campaign of killing, which wiped out a tenth of Rwanda's population, 70%, I think, of the Tutsi population, if, as you say, which seems like an organic response to something, and yet you've used the word organised before, which presumably was at the centre of the argument that this was a genocide?
Well, how it all came about is quite a long story, but the short point is, for a long time there had been tensions between the Hutu and the Tutsi, largely on the back of a colonial rule left behind by the Belgians. And the Tutsi, who were a minority within Rwanda, once majority rule came into place in, I think, 1961 or 2 out in Rwanda, all the people who were in positions of influence who were Tutsi within Rwanda were essentially taken out of power. There was a great fear then that there was going to be attacks, so a lot of Tutsi left the country and they lived in refugee camps around the border of Rwanda. Over time, they organized themselves to want to come back, led by Paul Kagame. And in around 1920, they started incursions from refugee camps on the border with Uganda into northern Rwanda. And that then set a lot of upset on the part of the Hutu, who were in control of the country. The UN was sent in to produce some peacekeeping to keep everything calm. And in the background, there was an organization called the MRND, which was the primary political organization led by the president, Mr. Habyarimana. And that organization created a youth militia called the Interahamwe. And as we moved through 1990 to 1992-93, great tensions began to arise on the part of the Hutu towards the Tutsi because there was this northern incursion. And the MRND, to some extent, through their militia, created stockpiles of weapons, and they also started preparing lists of people who were regarded as not sound.
Yes.
They were Hutu as well as Tutsi. And they, as soon as the president's plane came down, believed to have been shot down by the Tutsi, the genocide swung very quickly into action with roadblocks within 6 hours.
So, Ian, you talked there about the lists and the, you know, the stories are legion and horrific. And I know you've sat through, you know, so many hours of survivor testimony, I'm sure, but friends and neighbours turning on each other, family killing family, the brutal slaughter of people seeking shelter in churches. I mean, the stories are horrible. 25 years on, the Rwandan president, Paul Kagame, says the country is all one family again. And certainly Africa, Rwanda is one of Africa's success stories in terms of economic development. They have very strict laws in place to prevent ethnic discrimination, basically eliminating the idea of it. But there's also, you know, the Kagame regime is also accused of, you know, a lack of fresh press freedom, of disappearances. People are jailed for what's called divisionism, you know, if they're remotely critical of the government. What's your view of Rwanda 25 years on?
Well, I think Rwanda's come a very long way from the days of the genocide. At that time, there was very high illiteracy, and there wasn't very much investment in the country. Since then, the literacy rate is running into the very high 90s, so that people are much better educated. There is a lot of money that's gone into Rwanda from the international organizations. The place is very tidy, very clean, very well kept. It was the first country in Africa to ban, for example, plastic bags. And there's still communal work every, I think it's Friday, when people all gather together and they, you know, they clean things within the roads and the schools and the public areas. So it's a very organized place. It's part of the reason why the genocide took place. It was very organized with very strong connections
right
within the community upwards towards the hierarchy. As to how things are now, it is right to say, in fairness to President Kagame, that Rwanda is a much improved situation. There is a much better understanding of the importance of good relations between the Hutu and the Tutsi. There is no longer the differentiation allowed within passports and internal identity documents as to whether somebody is Tutsi or Hutu. So there is, I think, in fairness, quite a strong argument to be made that Rwanda has come through that darkness very well. Okay. Of course, there are some issues as to a perception that one side got prosecuted, namely the Hutu, and there's a suggestion that the Tutsi themselves committed some atrocities. If that happened, it was not on anywhere near the scale of what happened to the Tutsi civilian population at the hands of the Hutu. And there will always be a debate about that.
I'm sure. Ian, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you very much.
Justice Ian Morley QC, a High Court judge in Antigua and a former prosecutor at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda.